From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last month, Charles Vest stepped down as president of MIT, arguably the greatest research university on the planet. In his 14 years at the helm, he weathered many storms. Now, some are asking if the fundamental climate for scientific research in the United States may be changing, and not for the better. Tonight on Point, Charles Vest on American competitiveness, American security, and the future of American science. But first tonight, we go to Washington, where earlier today, the House and Senate convened for a state-by-state tally and certification of the electoral votes from November's presidential election. Vice President Dick Cheney presided over the meeting in his role as president of the Senate. The process went smoothly until Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones of Ohio filed a formal objection to the vote-counting process in her state.
I seek to object to the electoral votes of the state of Ohio on the ground that they were not, under all the circumstances known, regularly given, have signed objection, and I do have a senator.
Has the senator signed the objection?
The senator has signed the objection.
The one U.S. senator also signing the objection was Barbara Boxer of California. In a press conference earlier today, she outlined some of the reasons she decided to support the Ohio objection.
Why did voters in Ohio wait hours and hours and hours in the rain to vote? Why were voters at one precinct, for example, made to wait in line until nearly 4 a.m.?
For the latest on the story from Washington, we're joined now by John Harwood, national political editor of the Wall Street Journal. John Harwood, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, Tom. Happy New Year.
Same to you, my friend. Very, very unusual event here with this objection raised to the Electoral College certification today. Just how unusual, John?
Very unusual. This hasn't happened in more than a century. And really what you have is a hangover from the 2000 election. Very high emotions about that race and about this one. It was a close race. There were some irregularities in Ohio. It was unusual that people had to wait so long in the rain to vote, and sometimes not in the rain. But it doesn't appear that there were 118,000 votes worth of irregularities, and that's the margin by which George Bush carried that state.
So what's the dynamic here, John? The Democratic candidate, John Kerry, is not contesting the outcome. What exactly do you see the representatives and Senator Boxer, who stood up today, pursuing?
I think there were two things, Tom. One was a partisan point, and some liberal members of the Democratic base wanted to stand up and make a point, take a little bit of the enthusiasm off of the Republican majority in Congress, since they're all celebrating, of course, George W. Bush's victory. The second point is, I think, a broader one and a national one that has some merit to it, and that is that the national response to problems in election administration in the United States was pretty incomplete after 2000. Mm. There were some improvements made. Many states switched, Florida among them, to a more modern form of voting tabulation equipment. But there are still problems across the country, and there's need to do more. And Barbara Boxer and Stephanie Tubbs Jones were highlighting the need for that.
John, are there any, I don't know, processes that have been initiated? Is there anything underway that would try to prepare the ground better for the next presidential election or even earlier? I mean, people are talking here about the charges, disenfranchisement. That's a pretty fundamental problem in a democracy. Is there anything underway to more seriously address it than it's been addressed since 2000?
Well, we'll see whether Congress acts this time. They didn't do all that much after the 2000 election, and that was the biggest provocation for action that we've had. But, of course, within the parties, there's an awful lot of voter preparation and education that was done. One of the things that lessons Democrats drew from Florida in 2000 was that many of their own voters made mistakes casting ballots, and that cost the party, not just things that Republicans did. So both campaigns had very sophisticated campaigns through the mail, through the phone, through door knocking, to try to condition people to how to cast their ballots, the right place to cast their ballots, how they could preserve their rights through provisional ballots if they didn't feel like they were getting the right to vote. And all that is going to continue. And I think the clear result of this is going to be diminished problems as we go on. But it's certainly a far from perfect system now.
But that's preparing voters to deal with a flawed system. Shouldn't the attention be on fixing the flaws themselves?
Well, sure, and that's the issue, both in the Congress in Washington and in the states. The problem is that when you have very tight budgets, not just in Washington, but in state and local governments across the country, election administration tends to fall pretty rapidly to the bottom of the priority list once the immediate sort of glow of controversy fades in a particular election. And so, you know, new voting machines, more poll workers, more polling places have to compete with roads and school construction and all the other things that voters want from government.
In a democracy, though, maybe those need to be big priorities. John, what happens after today's objections? Is there any tail on this story, or is it done? Where does it stand?
No, I think it's done. The Congress ended up after a delay that forced the two houses to break up their joint session and meet separately. Have ended up approving the electoral tally. You had one faithless elector vote for John Edwards rather than John Kerry. But the electoral vote from November 2nd is now a fact, and George W. Bush is going to be sworn in on January 20th.
So it's on to Inauguration Day. John, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
You bet.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. One month ago today, Charles Vest stepped down as president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. During his 14 years at the helm of MIT, he was an outspoken advocate for America's national preeminence in science. He was a presence in Washington. He called for vigorous partnerships between academia, business, and government, for embracing top foreign students, for scientific research to be unfettered, open, and shared. He's still speaking out on the critical role that top universities play in keeping America at the forefront of global innovation. Tonight on Point, Charles Vest on the future of American science. You can join the conversation. Is America still committed in word and deed to global leadership in science? And will American universities dominate global scientific innovation in the 21st century as they did in the 20th? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Charles Vest. He was named president of MIT in 1990 and stepped down last month to make way for his successor, Susan Hockfield. Charles Vest has served on the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology in Republican and Democratic administrations. He was born in Morgantown, West Virginia, studied mechanical engineering, and was provost and vice president for academic affairs at the University of Michigan before coming to MIT. His new book is Pursuing the Endless Frontier, Essays on MIT and the Role of Research Universities. Charles Vest, it's wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Very glad to be here, Tom, and I'm very pleased you're addressing this important topic.
Well, we've been on it in a number of conversations recently, and it just seems to be growing in the level of concern and how front and center it is on Americans' minds. Here you go, after 14 years, right in the heart of the matter. What's your general assessment of the state of science? Do you leave confident or concerned you're posted at MIT?
Well, ironically, I leave both confident and concerned, and let me try to explain what I mean by that. First of all, this is the most exciting time in the history of science and technology. This is a great time to be a young person starting off a career in these exciting areas. At the same time, science and technology every day become more and more and more important to the future of our nation, quality of our life, our economy, our security, and really our general well-being. There's increasing emphasis today in countries all around the world on building their science and technology workforce and their infrastructure. And as all this is going on, our federal research funding in general is holding at most steady, declining in some very important areas, but really changing in nature and emphasis. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that as we go along. Mm-hmm. So to just summarize, I would say that we in the U.S. are still absolutely, undisputably the leader in advanced science and technology. But there are very disturbing trends. There's increasingly aggressive competition with other nations, and I think this is a real danger to us in what's clearly a knowledge age.
Let's look at the domestic side of this first. It's a big world out there, and it's an increasingly challenging world. Everybody knows about that, jobs going overseas and not just stuffing circuit boards anymore. You've written about the sort of three legs of a stool of pushing research forward, the federal support, the corporate piece of this, and the research university or the academic leg. We should look at those three legs of the stool and how each are doing. Is everything carrying its load these days, or how is it shifting?
It's shifting pretty rapidly. And if we go back to kind of look at a historical time frame or progression of federal research funding, go back to about 1970, we had three basic categories of research, that in engineering, that in the physical sciences, and that in the biomedical sciences. They were all about equal. Now we look back after this period of 30-plus years, and we discover that in real purchasing power, the investment in physical science and in engineering has just about stayed constant. In fact, it's dropped a little bit. The investment in biomedical research has increased by a factor of almost six.
Mm-hmm.
So the portfolio has changed remarkably. But the reason the federal support is so important, and I think people on both sides of the aisle agree with this is a very fundamental federal responsibility to support basic, frontier, new knowledge-generating research. Industry's share of the R&D in this country has, in fact, increased rather dramatically over the last 10 to 20 years. And they now supply about 60% or so of the R&D funding. But if you look across both the federal government's portfolio and certainly the portfolio of industry, the emphasis is increasingly on development and on very short time frame kinds of research and development. And the truly fundamental frontier work in most fields is less and less supported every year by both of these sectors.
When you say development, you mean product development as opposed to kind of fundamental scientific breakthroughs.
I mean product development as opposed to new breakthroughs. And what's the role of the universities and what is our health? Again, this is a little bit mixed because I think our institutions, both public and private, have never been stronger. But on the other hand, their contributions to science and technology have never been of greater fundamental importance to the future of our nation. So they're healthy at the moment, but they're very worried about the decline in support of basic research. Why do I think this is so important? The U.S. has had a very important historical advantage for decades now, basically since the end of the Second World War, because we have this internationally unique combination of strong basic research and education in our very best universities especially, and a free enterprise system. And so from this, we've developed a very strong economy for these times, but everybody else around the world has learned from us very quickly, and believe me, they're going to continue to challenge us. So I think the biggest danger we face is simply complacency.
Complacency?
Complacency.
But at a time like this when we can feel the hot breath of China and India, and just for starters, why complacency now?
Well, because people have gotten so used to being in the lead that they think that new knowledge and innovation and the underlying science kind of grow on trees. And they forget that it must be a very explicit investment on the part of our nation. You remember the old lead, follower, get out of the way. We're so used to leading that the other two possibilities aren't on most people's radar screen, but they should be.
And yet they should be. We're talking tonight with Charles Vest. Last month he stepped down as president of MIT. We're looking at American science, American competitiveness. We'll look at American security in relationship to both of those as well. His new book is Pursuing the Endless Frontier. You can join the conversation tonight. Is America still committed in word and deed to global leadership in science. Will American universities dominate global scientific innovation in this century as they did in the last one? And maybe this, will U.S. universities still harvest the world's best scientific minds in this century, or will those minds go elsewhere? Are they already going? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the longtime, just departing president of MIT, Charles Vest, on American science, American competitiveness, and American security. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. How are you feeling tonight about the future of American science? How does it look from where where you sit from your lab bench? That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charles Vest, so much I want to get into with you, but 9/11 has loomed over every aspect of American life. It surely has loomed over your life leading at MIT in recent years. The issue of national security, the importance of guarding borders and yet having the free flow of information and of people. How is the country's much heightened concern with security affecting research universities, great research universities like MIT and others?
It's clearly having a negative effect at the moment. We face some very serious issues to the important openness of our universities. We face issues having to do with people. Primarily the increasing difficulty and complexity of international students to obtain visas to come to study in this country, even greater difficulties with scientific and other professional visitors simply coming to the U.S. briefly for meetings and engagement, so people problems. Also problems of openness of ideas and scientific and technological communication. And all this together, I'm sorry to say, has created an increasingly negative image of the U.S. Around the country, particularly in Europe, but also in Asia, where we are simply not viewed as having the welcome mat out these days to the extent that we traditionally have. Why I think that is so important is that, without question, one of the primary factors that have made this nation great, and especially that have made our system of higher education great over decades, has been our openness to bright men and women from other countries to come here as students, to come here as faculty members, to come here and become entrepreneurs. You walk through Silicon Valley today, and I think the number is something like over 30% of the CEOs of all the Silicon Valley companies came here from other countries as graduate students. Are hugely important to our economy. And this openness has, in my view, not only increased the quality and excellence of our science and technology, it has dramatically increased the quality of the education we provide to our own students who were born and grew up here in the U.S., and we really have to be concerned about this. Now, having said that, we all understand that we face very real and very daunting challenges out there in this age of terrorism. And it is my opinion and observation that our federal officials, particularly at the highest levels, have been working very hard to strike the right balance between openness and security. But I think the result to this point is too biased against the traditional openness of the country, and I hope we can build a better balance going forward.
Full disclosure, I guess I should say my good wife, Danielle Guichard, has worked in your MIT vineyards on exactly this front. You have a reputation, Charles Vest, for telling it like it is. If this flow of great minds from around the world to the United States, to universities like MIT, Caltech, and others, isn't kept healthy and open, what do you see the consequences?
Well, I think the consequences are absolutely clear. The quality of our institutions, the quality of the research we do, and the quality of the education we provide will slide downhill. I have just no question about that. You know, Tom, I look at our own faculty at MIT. We're very proud of the large number of Nobel Prizes that have been won by our faculty. And I look where those people were born. the dominant country is, in fact, the U.S. But you go beyond that. They were born in India, in Germany, in Mexico, in China. And that's what has made this country great. And if we lose that edge of being the beacon, the magnet for the best and brightest around the world, there's no question that the quality of our institutions will slide downhill. And once that begins to slide downhill, the underpinnings for our system of innovation that have to drive our economy in the future will weaken, no question.
But whatever the kind of resistance those people may run into at the border or with U.S. security measures, isn't it inevitable to some degree with the tremendous economic development in countries like China and India that we won't have the same flow of the best and the brightest, as you say, from those countries in the year ahead? They can stay home and make a pile of money and do great research at the same time, can they not, or will they not be able to?
We still need to be the best. We need to be the most nimble, the best. We've got to define the cutting edge of these fields. Yes, people in China and Japan and Germany and Vietnam, they're all every bit as smart as we are. And as they are provided increasing opportunities at home, I think on the whole that's good. All boats will rise in this ocean. But we are so dependent in this country on driving our economy through advanced knowledge that we've got to stay out at the cutting edge, and part of the way of doing that is to maintain this great openness.
Let me ask you about exactly that. I think some Americans have begun to imagine that this country won't simply be the best, as you say, in science. You've got big competitors, they've got lots of ambition, and they're increasingly deep pockets that will be one of many. But that flow of brain power that you're describing depends on being the best. Can the United States realistically expect in this century to be the best, to define the cutting edge, as you say, or do we have to share that? And if it's a shared frontier, what happens to that flow of brain power?
Science is a shared activity. Let me be very clear about that. I think overall it is healthy that countries are coming up the scale, and we hope that other people will at some point have the same kind of wealth and quality of life that that we have. But we have to face the reality that many of the things that used to drive our economy and provide the primary employment in this country are now going elsewhere. And in this age of globalization, there's an inevitability to the fact that certain parts of our manufacturing enterprise and so forth are going to move overseas, or first going to go to the relatively advanced Asian countries, and then they go on down the scale to the next country. And we have to replace that with something. And in my view, the only way that we can continue to succeed in this country is to be the nation that defines the leading edge, that does the most sophisticated, high-level kind of work, and also is the source of the new knowledge and new innovation that drives the new industries and new things at the bottom. We have to do those two things.
And you're saying in spite of all this new competition, that's achievable, that's doable in this century?
It has to be our goal. I think it may be the case that the extent of our lead, the gap, if you will, between us and other developed nations is going to decrease. I think that's not all bad. But our goal has to nonetheless be to stay out at the leading edge.
We're talking tonight with Charles Vest, longtime president of MIT, who stepped down just last month. His new book is Pursuing the Endless Frontier. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Emily is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to address the natural sciences for a second, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
My father is a professor for Duke University, their marine lab and at the coast of North Carolina.
Great.
And not only is he having trouble with his international students, but he's having a lot of trouble with funding. I think that we really need to look to fund these things. I think it's very important because a lot of the economies around the world are depending upon the ability to keep our oceans clean and all that stuff so we can fish. And I don't think there's enough funding for that. My second point is that in the county that I'm teaching in, we are starting science end-of-grade assessments,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the teachers don't know how to teach it. And I think that if we're going to be worried about science in the future, then we need to fund it today, and we need to get people excited about it.
And people who can teach it, Emily. We've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Charles Vest, 2 points there. If you'd hit the first one on natural sciences and the future there first, and then we've got to turn to this issue of American education. But first on natural sciences, Emily's saying, come on, we've got to save the planet. Is there a funding problem?
Emily, your call is extremely relevant and makes a very important point. The natural sciences are incredibly important. Duke is a great university, and their program in marine areas is very well known. And if a place like that is feeling the squeeze, not only of attracting the right students, but also getting funding, it makes the point I've been trying to make. And it's interesting that you mention the whole ocean and whole marine area, because this is a great example. The ocean is a big unknown out there, and the biodiversity within the ocean may end up producing new medicines for us. It's clear that it's going to produce some of the keys to stewarding the quality of our environment overall. It's a great example of a field where we don't know where the applications are ultimately going to come, but believe me, it's important. And this is exactly the kind of thing that the federal government and our private foundations have to pull together and let good people like your father have the wherewithal to achieve their dreams and ambitions.
Now, on the front of education, American education, this is huge. Emily looks at her own schools in her own county. You must, at MIT, look at the flow of students, American students coming in through your doors, or potential applicants. I know you have many, but yet in the long run, we see these falling scores in science. We see the declining or stagnant numbers of Americans getting into science and engineering. Can we have that cutting-edge research you're talking about if we don't have an inflow of top-flight students coming out of America's schools?
Certainly not. And I think we all agree that there is a national disgrace here across a lot of our K-12 system. It's hard to think about it sitting here at a place like MIT or sitting down at Duke University, because what's happened is there's an incredible bifurcation in the country. We get the most remarkable, well-educated young men and women attending places like Duke and MIT. We're really fortunate. But if you look at the overall trends, for every one of these fine young kids who comes to schools like this, there are many, many more who have not even begun to achieve the potential that they have. Emily made the point that we hear all over the country in our public schools, which is men and women teaching science who don't really have any education in science. So I think there's some fundamentals here that we can't forget. And one is that we have to make more room for people to be educated in the very fields that they're teaching at the K-12 level. I happen to be one who believes that despite all the pitfalls, it is important to get metrics out there and measure progress.
The No Child Left Behind style measurements.
Well, that style at least. I don't know whether this is the right detail.
But you want tests. You want measurement.
I want tests and measurement and qualitative assessments as well, of course. We have to pay teachers, and we have to pay those who do a good job well. It is an irony that I can never understand that 90% of the people in the United States will tell you that there's nothing more important than educating our young people. But they don't put their money where their mouth is. They don't make the careers exciting and generate a feeling of importance and accomplishment in our teachers. We really have to come to grips with this problem.
How much longer can the country go on without a significant improvement in that K-12 education that you're saying is a big problem? When does it begin to eat away at the foundations of even an enormous research institute like MIT?
Well, it eats away in two ways. First of all, as you begin to get fewer and fewer people who believe that their education is important and believe that science and mathematics are important to young people and so forth, you're going to generate a body politic that doesn't care about this and doesn't support the things that we have to do. And more importantly still, of course, we're not going to produce the quality of workforce that we need in the future. And we're not just talking about people who are going to be PhD scientists to work at almost any level in almost any industry, whether it's service or manufacturing you can imagine. You have to have quantitative skills, computational skills, a more scientific-tinged understanding of the world just to do your work.
You put it gently, but it sounds, when you think about it, pretty dire. And this issue of a culture sort of drifting away from valuing those things, if you're not going to succeed without being at the cutting edge, that's a scary thought. Michael's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, and that speaks to my point. The question is, can we expect to maintain scientific preeminence with a leadership and culture that's positively, or at least a lot of whom, are positively antithetical to a naturalistic, objective, or at least reasonably fact-based view of the world?
Straight-up question, and a huge one, Michael. Thanks. Charles Vest?
Well, the answer is probably no. And it is what, to me, makes this problem so difficult to think about, because I'm afraid that underlying all the problems that we do face in K through 12, and especially in areas like science and mathematics, is a shifting culture that does not internalize the importance of these things, does not value them, and that looks for the quick fix and is more interested in entertainment and suing each other and so forth. Somehow we've got to get beyond that, because believe me, if you go around Asia and you visit even China, if you visit Japan, if you visit Singapore and so forth, they know better.
What do you think about the Bush administration's leadership on this front, Charles Vest?
Insufficient. I think that the thinking that went into the No Child Left Behind Act is by and large good, and I know that people can argue one way or another on details. I don't see the evidence as a citizen just reading the newspapers that it is funded at the level we need to do. But I think that there is within the Bush administration an understanding that it is a national problem. And I would like to hope that as the president enters his second term, that this will get higher on the importance list within the federal government.
And do you see a conflict between the push for science and the greater, it's been called the values issue or the kind of religious tinge of this government? Is there a conflict there? The allegation's been made, you know, that that belief is taking a higher position compared to scientific investigation. Do you feel that happening?
Well, I don't know that I'm prepared simply to say I feel that happening. I'd like to start by saying this is a democracy, and I think it is important that we recognize each other's views and we debate these things openly. People do bring value systems to the table. But for my own taste, we are drifting too far away from an objective view of the world, from an understanding that it really is our knowledge and the use of our brains that drive us forward. I'd like to see that more at the center of things.
We're talking tonight with Charles Vest. He's just stepped down as president of MIT. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by Charles Vest. He was president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for 14 years, stepped down a month ago today, if I've got that right. He's out with a new book called Pursuing the Endless Frontier. Talking with him tonight about American science, American competitiveness, and American security. You can join the conversation. Is America still committed in word and deed to global leadership in science? And is America, are you still committed to the idea of open, unfettered scientific research on every front? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charles Vest, you know, of course, scientific progress is often challenging, and stem cell research has been a particularly challenging one for lots of people to get their minds around, their ethics around, very different views on what the country ought to do here. Are there, in your view, after all these years in scientific education and research, are there avenues of research that simply shouldn't be pursued?
Well, I think it's a question that is a legitimate one for the nation, for the body politic. We are kind of moving over to what are clearly personal opinions and personal values and personal views. I happen to agree on the ban on actual human cloning. I do not think it is morally and ethically acceptable to try to create new human beings in our own image and so forth.
Even when we've got $50,000 dog clones or kitty clones out there already.
I happen to believe that. But on the other hand, I am disappointed in the quality of the debate nationally that preceded the decision that the federal government made, at least for the time being, regarding stem cell research. As I said a moment ago, I think we should celebrate the fact that in a democracy we open up the discussion of issues like this to people other than just the scientists, that people can bring religious arguments, ethical arguments, political arguments to the table. And there's some times we've done this well in the past. I look back at the leadership that people like my good colleague out at Caltech, David Baltimore, and others played in the early days of our ability to do recombinant DNA work, when there was a similar kind of aversion and fright of where we were heading.
It was very new. And
they actually,
hard to,
as you know, established a brief moratorium and engaged a serious dialogue with politicians, with community activists, with people representing religion, as well as with the scientific and medical communities. And at the end of that time, we actually emerged with a very strong consensus about how to move forward and what the safeguards were that had to be put in place. And I just did not detect in the country that same quality of ultimately mutually respectful dialogue. And I'd like to believe that if we'd had it, if we'd done it a little bit better, that we would have come out in a very different place on stem cell research. Because while we don't know exactly where it will lead, there are clear indications that very bright people believe that it is the key to therapies in important disease areas. And we know, among other things, that just because we decide not to pursue it, lots of other countries in this world that are going to. And so I don't think we came to the right conclusion. I hope that the current perspective of the government is not a permanent one. And it's my personal hope that this will see some further debate and discussion over the next couple of years here. And maybe policy could be modified. I hope it will.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is moving on that front and all of California. Do you really see President Bush moving on this? You've worked closely with this administration and others. This is tied into some pretty basic political positions.
I honestly can't answer the question. I have no idea what is in the president's mind in this regard at the moment. But, you know, I believe that while we can have violent disagreements over one issue or another and over what's right and left and Republican, Democrat, and so forth, my observation over these 14 years is that the vast majority of officials in Washington want to do the right thing and, at the end of the day, do what they think is important and right for the nation. And so I would hope that there is some room for movement and change there.
Greg's calling from New York City. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to first say I really enjoy your show, particularly the depth that you go into.
Thanks, Greg.
And this is a terribly important topic to be tackling. I want to move back to an item that was mentioned earlier in the show, discussing the capital for maintaining our country's innovative edge in the world.
Yes.
And I believe that one of the greatest hindrances to this is the current obsession with intellectual property. Now, I'm not expressing sour grapes here. I'm actually a patent holder.
Okay.
And I rue the day that patent was issued, because what I've seen since that time is how the process prevents technology from moving out into the public sector, and very rarely produces the overall result that was originally intended by the patent system.
And Gregor, are you seeing an evolution in a way that you don't like in the way intellectual property is understood?
Absolutely. Everything is being claimed as intellectual property. It's become virtually a real estate land grab.
Mm.
And what happens is that it actually slows the pace of innovation. And this is the thing that really concerns me, because as your guest Charles mentioned, you can either lead, follow, or get out of the way. If we're going to maintain our leadership, we have to be continually innovating. Once you've come up with an innovation, it's history. You have to move on to the next thing. That's the only way that you can stay ahead of the other global players.
So if that range is too tightly fenced, you don't have that room to move. Greg, we've got it, and thank you for that. Charles Vest, what about the issue of intellectual property? We hear a lot about how it's getting tougher and tougher to maneuver out there, people surrounding patents with other patents, a kind of gridlock sometimes.
You know, Greg used a term that we maybe haven't used enough this evening, because he talked about innovation. And innovation is, in fact, more than just basic science. Our innovation system in this country involves the creation of new knowledge, new technologies through research. It involves the education of men and women who can create and understand this new knowledge and technologies. And it has to move to the marketplace. And Greg is absolutely right that the intellectual property regime is a very important part of the structure of that pathway to move these things out of the laboratory and out of the idea stage and into the marketplace. We had in Washington 2 weeks ago, through the work of the Council on Competitiveness, which is a group of industry CEOs, university presidents, and labor leaders who try to develop policy about competition and innovation. We had a National Innovation Summit that was co-chaired by Sam Palmisano, the CEO of IBM, and Wayne Clough, the president of Georgia Tech. Mm. And there was a very clear feeling in that group, which is dominated by industry, that we don't have it exactly right on intellectual property. And just like Greg, everybody believes it is important. We know that the patent system is fundamental, that at some level, if you don't have the ability to own intellectual property, it won't make it into the marketplace. But there's a deep concern that IP is coming in at too early a stage in certain fields, particularly in the biomedical world, which is very complex. There's a feeling that too many kinds of things are patentable. And I've yet to hear anybody who's articulated a crisp, clear conclusion to all this. But I think there's a great feeling that we do need to rethink some of the approach to IP and try to get back in the right balance that still gives people the opportunity to own and ultimately to generate revenues on the basis of true innovation and invention, but kind of stops the noise level around it that gets in the way of certain IP being used as tools for other people to innovate. It's complicated. I don't have a simple answer, but it's something we need to continually monitor and think about, and I think the council in particular is very dedicated to doing just that.
Greg, good luck there, and thanks for your call. Mary Ann's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary Ann. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a physician, and in undergraduate school, I was a chemistry major. The most valuable thing that I got from my undergraduate education was not the knowledge of chemistry per se, but the ability to think analytically, critically, and deductively to come to a conclusion about a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And also the ability to think creatively. And it seems to me, in talking with younger people that I know and some very bright younger people, that I have a concern that maybe being taught how to think is not being done as well as it should be, and maybe that's a result of our technological age. Computers are thinking for us.
Marianne, our time is growing short, but let me put it to Charles Vest. Dr. Vest, have you seen it at MIT in your students? More broadly, do you see a change in the way young Americans are thinking?
Almost a decade ago, we did a remarkable study, actually commissioned a remarkable study, that showed the huge number, over 4,000 companies that had been founded by MIT graduates. One of the most interesting things, to make Marianne's point, one of the most interesting things in that study was that there was zero correlation between what students had majored in at MIT and what their companies did.
So they could apply in many directions.
Which really makes this point that she has made, that the most important thing we teach people is how to think, how to analyze problems, how to work creatively, how to solve real problems, how to work together increasingly to do that. And I don't know that we're perfect, but I believe that most of our universities have that right on the front burner in education, to teach people to learn how to learn, to teach them how to think quantitatively. Maybe we've lost a little bit of that discipline. I'm not one of those who tends to say just because people do everything on the computer, they've forgotten how to do this. The world changes, we evolve, we move forward. But I do appreciate Marianne's reminding us of the importance of this, not only in higher education, but this is also a real key getting back down into the K through 12 area. I mentioned the fact that to do almost any job in our society today requires a different kind of quantitative and problem-solving skill than we have traditionally taught. So I thank her for reminding us of that.
Charles Vest, a lot of big, challenging issues you're raising here tonight, but you began the hour, and I want to get back to it, talking about just what an exciting time this is in science as well. When you look out on that great frontier, that endless frontier from the title of your book, feed us some nectar here about the exciting stuff. What's got your attention? What are you looking at? What are the fronts where you see great possibilities?
Well, many of the fronts of frontiers have become, unfortunately, buzzwords, but they're very real. What is exciting to me these days is that we have developed the tools to work on more and more complex problems. We have developed the tools to work at faster and faster time scales and smaller spatial scales. So now you hear all these words like nanoscale technology and microtechnology and so forth. And what's wonderful is that there is this blending of physical science and life science and information science that's all over places like MIT and Duke and Caltech and Stanford. Just go look at what the young faculty are doing. These frontiers are so exciting, and they're cutting across all the old traditional boundaries. And boy, I'd love to go back and start over. We look out and see fields, as you may know, Tom, at MIT. We've invested very vigorously in brain and cognitive science because we believe all of a sudden we have the computational tools, we have the instrumentation tools, we have the biological knowledge of how cells work. Know how to work with more and more complex systems. We know how to do things non-invasively to look at metabolism in the brain. This is just going to explode in fundamental knowledge that we believe will ultimately improve the ability of humans to communicate, to learn, and hopefully lead to therapies for mental and emotional diseases. That's a good example. And just to close off, we need to look at the macroscopic side as well, because we've got to feed this planet, we've got to create energy for this planet, and we've got to keep our environment clean. The challenges, the opportunities are just wonderful. We need to take advantage of them.
Charles Vest, the endless frontier never looks so good. Let's just keep the country headed right out there. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles Vest just stepped down after 14 years as president of MIT. His new book is Pursuing the Endless Frontier, Essays on MIT and the Role of Research Universities. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.